You know, since the 1700s, it's been suggested that between 9 and 10 million people were born in Ireland. As a result of that, there are people with Irish ancestry spread all over the world, and I'm one of them. My name is Seamus O'Hooligan Jr., Black Irishman. The elements that made me were around before I was even born. The year was 1969. The place, a dairy farm in Bethel, New York. The reason? A three-day festival of peace and music and a lot of drugs. You're saying to yourself, it sounds like he's talking about Woodstock. That's because you're a hippie and you're damn right. Yes, Woodstock, the musical event where 33 acts were supposed to perform. One of the musical acts that got cut was a popular Irish banjo and violin band out of Dublin, Seamus O'Hooligan and the Hooligans. Seamus O'Hooligan was my dad. Now, my pops was the leader of the group. I once tracked down an old Irish buddy of his that ran the streets with him when he was a kid.
Hey, you ran the streets with your daddy back in 1955. Fingers was a talented musician, and all the girls used to call Seamus Fingers. He had long ones and a knack for strumming the banjo and singing old Negro spirituals by people like Paul Robeson. Man, we would sit around for hours, regaled by his unique fingering and fanula. That was his banjo.
Yeah, Pops formed a group with his mates, Seamus O'Hooligan and the Hooligans. They're going to perform at Woodstock, or so they thought, until stage manager Johnny delivered the news.
We've been cut, Fingers. What? They cut us, man. They booked too many acts, and they've anticipated a crowd of 50,000. I don't understand. What's the fucking problem? Look around you, man. There's a 500,000 people out here. Not enough toilets, too many drugs, and did I mention not enough toilets? Johnny, this was a done deal. We came all this way. I was just smoking a fat one with Joe Cocker. Look, Seamus, I was just talking to Janice.
You mean Janice Joplin?
She said this crowd ain't in the banjo music.
For the fuck's sake, Johnny. When you describe it like that, it's not faking banjo music. It's just faking music.
And that there's another thing. They're screwing like they'll fill a country out there. I'm sorry, Fingers, but we're chopped, man.
So, dejected, Seamus wandered with his banjo in hand out into an empty field, seeking solace away from his band and the Woodstock crowd. He climbed and perched himself up onto a rectangled bale of hay and began to pluck at his banjo, Fanula. Minutes later, his tuneful strumming met upon the ears of a beautiful African woman that walked upon him.
Hey, what's all this noise you're making over here?
Oh, hello, you delightful creature, you.
Hello, baby. What's up?
Well, this noise, as you put it, I call that music.
Are you sure about that?
Wow, you got an accent. Where are you from?
Well. Isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? Where's your accent from?
Guilty as charged. I guess I'm Seamus O'Hooligan. I'm what you might call a warm Irish pot. And dare I say, a great admirer of lovely black cattle.
Oh, are you now? But first, I don't think I have an accent, and I am Diane, a kettle originally from Zambia. That's in Africa, you know.
Diane? I must say, that doesn't sound very much like an African name.
Well, what were you expecting? Something like Chifulu, Lembani, Chakamanda?
Yeah.
Now, in addition to his long, nimble fingers, Seamus was gifted with a silver tongue, and he had talked himself upon some raw African-American ass. That raw ass was my mom. So he kept dropping the charm and serenading her with a banjo. Unfortunately for him, there were only two things my mom ever hated in life, okra and the banjo.
Sweetheart, you talk a good game, but I gotta tell you, those fingers are talking to me. But I absolutely hate the sound of that damn banjo.
Whoa, sounds like it's about to storm out there.
And I'm heading for that barn.
Pardon me, Miss Diane, but is this your farm?
Seamus, do you really care if it's my farm or not? Nobody's around, and you're this close to getting some. That is, if you can get your pot into the barn.
Will Seamus get his pot into the barn? If he does get his pot into the barn, will some exquisite fingering take place? If he doesn't get his pot into the barn, will I ever be born? Tune in next time for Seamus O'Hooligan Jr., Black Irishman.
One thing I've learned after all these years, you're gonna save yourself a whole lot of tears. Don't try to figure out who was wrong and who was right. Got to move along, baby. Let's ride. You got to roll with the punches. Yeah, you got to go with the flow.
Punches. Hi, everybody. Your old friend Mike Houlihan. Welcome back to Hibernian Radio. This is show number 269. We're brought to you by Madden Funds, Local 150, Fox's Pizza, Flood Brothers, and Guinness is good for you. You can hear the show every Saturday night from 7 to 8, streaming online at Global Irish Radio. That's GIR.IE. And usually catch the podcasts that are posted by Sunday night, Monday at the latest. So we're so glad to have you back. Hope you enjoyed that episode one of Seamus O'Hooligan Jr., Black Irishman. We're returning to those, and we're going to keep playing them for another 10 weeks, and then Greg Holloman will have some new ones for us. Very honored tonight to have two great guests with us. Our old friend Gene Roy is here. Gene has been on the show many times. 30 years with the Chicago Police Department. Grew up on the South Side, St. Joachim's Parish, around 88th and Cottage. He met police officers then, and then he became a cop for the next 30 years. He served as a patrolman, a homicide detective, a sergeant in patrol, detectives on an administration before being promoted to lieutenant, captain, and the district commander of the 9th District in Bridgeport. He returned to the detective division where he served as deputy chief and the chief of detectives until he retired. Gene works as a consultant on law enforcement investigations and public safety in his spare time. He works with Chaplain Time. Is that his name? Perry? What? Okay. Anyway, he's very involved in the peer-to-peer situation with the police. And he recommended that we meet with Dr. Cammie
Juswin.
Like your parents probably said, Juswin. Just win. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And she's like the resident shrink, right? Psychologist, doctor. Her signature work in the field of first responders wellness is the workshop she has organized and runs on a frequent basis over at Haymarket House, which our friend Father Iggy McDermott started. Cammie has a PhD in licensed clinical psychologist, holds professional board certifications as a diplomat in police and public safety personnel, trauma, diplomatic. She currently is the police psychologist for the Bartlett, Illinois Police Department. Long, long career working with the mental health of police officers, and we thank you so much for that. And you've had quite the career as well. So you guys met. How long have you known each other?
Probably about 8 years now, Yeah.
So Cammie, one of the things we were just talking about was the recent shooting of some guy who took a shot at the police and didn't end well for him. But you're probably, one of the reasons we do this show is because we're dedicated to Irish first responders, our cops, firefighters, paramedics, and nurses, because we feel they're the modern day equivalent of our ancient Irish mythological warriors. And they have been great for the last 5 years. And those are the people keeping our society together. You know, the glue, like you guys both are. So we're happy to have you on the show. And anything you want to tell me, tell me. Go ahead, Tammie.
Well,
Cammie, sorry.
So I had the privilege about 8 years ago of Gene reaching out. He was interested in the Northern Illinois Critical Incident Team. So I remember the first time I met Gene, I came into the restaurant and I saw him and I stood there like, oh my God, I've seen you on TV forever.
Oh, yeah.
And I had this look on my face and he was like, are you like embarrassed to meet me? I was like, no, yeah. I'm so honored to be sitting here. So we both are on the Northern Illinois Critical Incident Stress Management team.
Oh, okay.
And do debriefings all through Northern Illinois. It's the busiest team in the nation, one of the largest. And I would say there are about 70, 75 people on the yep. team. And it's law enforcement, and we're all volunteers, law enforcement, fire, EMS, hospital, dispatching, mental health, chaplain. Yeah. And as I said, we don't cost anything. And so any department, agency, or hospital who has a critical incident can call the 1-800 number and arrange to have a debriefing.
Oh,
and,
wow. So you're like on call.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And what they do is they send out a page or a text, and here's the service, here's where it is. And you text back or call back and say, I can do it. Like, I'm going to do one tomorrow out in the western suburbs mm-hmm. for an infant death. And but we end up doing a lot with, one of the larger law enforcement. We seem to always, there are about three or four of us who always end right. up at the same ones. And and then Haymarket Center, just a little, one of the reasons I went to work for them was, number one, they do incredible things in the community.
Yeah.
You know, they,
it's facility,
substance
great.
Abuse,
yeah.
And they never turn anyone away for mm-hmm. lack of pay. So I really applaud them. And when I left the hospital that I had been at forever, and I said, I'm never going back to an agency ever again. And then when I saw what Haymarket had to offer, and I do clinical training supervision there, but I also said to Dr. Lustig, who is the CEO, I have this idea. I've been trying to get it off the ground since before COVID, and I just can't get the mechanisms right for the finances. So he said, let me see your proposal. And out of that proposal, he called me back and he said, we need our first one in August. So August of 2022,
yeah.
We rolled out all of the persons who participate in the retreat are all volunteers.
Wow.
So none of us get paid for it. Gene has been at every single one, as has, I could list everybody's name, you know, so incredible team of really experienced law enforcement, lots of different types of law enforcement, nursing, medical, federal disaster responders, and mental health who donate their time. And we average probably 16 to 20 people for 4 days.
Oh, dear.
And yeah. Haymarket.
And they're like patients, basically, right?
Well, no, they're guests. We call them guests.
Okay.
We call them their guests,
but they're
all
law enforcement.
Well, they're law enforcement, firefighter, paramedic, hospital. We have a lot of tactical teams. Mm-hmm. Admin, we have and federal level disaster personnel, because they tend to already be in the in a workplace, and then they also are on some of the federal teams for intermittent employees. Like, I'm a federal level disaster responder, so I work all these other jobs, but if there's a federal disaster, I'm rostered. I can go there. And so we serve about 16 to 22 participants every couple of months. And the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, the Mitchell model of debriefing, typically sends one of their people as a peer supporter. And there's no competition amongst our team at all. We're all there for helping our responders who've been through horrendous events. And
I saw a thing yesterday. Jonathan Jackson, Jesse Jackson's son,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking to black members of the community, and talking about how the Chicago Fire Department doesn't care about black people when their house burns. I mean, just lie after lie after mm-hmm. lie. It has not been a good time for our first responders
no.
the last 4 or 5 years. It's just no. awful. And you got the media constantly, you know, I have a not-for-profit dedicated to Irish causes, one of them being first responders, and there's a group called Fund Something. They critique your funding proposals. Mm-hmm. So I sent them mine for, we have 200 of these interviews now, mm-hmm. and we were going to make a film out of it. And I said, here's what we're doing, and we believe, you know, that our Irish first responders are the modern-day equivalent, blah, blah, blah. And it comes back, and they said, you're a white supremacist.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe that? I went nuts. I mean, it really pissed me off.
Yeah.
And that it's just reinforced in the media, and I see all this, you know, I see Jonathan Jackson, that faker, and mm-hmm. it's like, give me a break. You know, I'll tell you a quick funny story. I work for the Irish Echo, and my boss is former Lord Mayor of Belfast, and so he travels all over the country, and he sent me a text and said, I just met the congressman from the 19th Ward. Could you do a piece on him? And I went, who's the congressman of the 19th Ward? And he goes, Jonathan Jackson. I said, no way. He's a race baiter and a grifter. He was shocked. I went, are you kidding? You're not paying me enough to go write something on that jerk. Anyway, and I'm going to send him that story that he just did to the fire department. Just awful. But it's continual.
Yeah.
You know? You need a voice. And, you know, we're low wattage, but we're doing everything we can to say, hey, this is not right, you know?
Well, some of the stories that, you know, you see on the reels, on social media,
yeah.
on YouTube, sometimes on LinkedIn, especially where some of the footage is after a department has released the footage.
Yeah.
What's interesting is how many times when people in the program will tell their story, like, I'm here because I had this incident happen and I could really use some support with it.
Sure.
And we'll all be standing there looking at each other like, I saw this footage.
Yeah.
And you know, I think one of the, you know, you had asked for stories, and one that comes to my mind is, as I said, I work for Bartlett. I've been there for about
the Village of Bartlett. Yeah.
The Village of Bartlett. I've been a contractor there for about 14 years now.
Yeah.
We had two incidents. We have two major roads that run through the village, and high impact, a lot of accidents in the area. And within 2 weeks, we had the same two officers in two squads. There was a pullover. They pulled someone over for some reason, and somebody suspected of driving under the influence.
Right.
Hit the car that was covering the first officer.
Oh.
And so, you know, damaged car one, damaged car two. And then on the second one, hit the car, the back car, so powerfully that it flipped the car on its side and kind of spinning, nearly hitting one of the officers.
Yeah.
And so the photo that I use, it's a photo from the newspaper, so it's kind of public domain. In my lecture is of that instance, and there were a couple of the Illinois State Police mm-hmm. who they were actually the first one on the scene.
Yeah.
And we do education as part of the retreat, and I said, so when you look at, you know, repeated and compounded exposure to stress, the fact that both of the one officer nearly was hit twice,
yeah.
and the second time, had he not had that sort of inkling that something bad was happening, mm-hmm. he would have been hit very badly.
Yeah.
And so I said, for all you ISP folks who are in the room, if you know who these two people are that are in the photo, thank you for taking care of
What's USP?
I'm Illinois State Police.
Illinois State Police. Okay. Yeah.
And I said, will you will you tell them how grateful I am that you were there to take care of my guys? Not that I could have done anything, but yeah. my job is to help take care of them.
Yeah.
And three officers put their hands up and they said, that's us.
Oh, no kidding.
We just happened to be
there.
Yeah. And, and like, I started crying. I said, I just need a minute because it was this really profound feeling of how we, you know, we depend on each other and we take care of it. We take care of each other. And so the whole idea of the retreat, Dr. Lustig said that he will find the funding for it. And he has, and we've secured federal funding.
Yeah.
He said in his belief, continuing Father McDermott's mission, was a healthy community starts by taking care of its responders and those who take care of us. And so we have, I think, 8 retreats funded and scheduled this year.
Terrific.
And working on grants.
And so it's
all
cops,
the time.
Firefighters, it's just first responders?
We say first responders and telecom, the dispatchers are included in that.
As they should be.
And then we say essential medical. So you can get your first line hospital people. Because critical care is different than the rest of hospital
care.
And
they're seeing this stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, our disaster responders as well. I mean, you know, I did 2 deployments during COVID, 1 in the morgue in New York. And so and most of them are typically in death work or
death
police
work.
Officers. Oh, yeah.
Boy.
The last responder. So actually, our logo says the last responder.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, we try to take care of that whole range of individual who is out there every day, you know, the mundane all the way to the horrible.
Yeah.
And it's really an interesting process when they get together. No group has been the same.
No. Oh, they're all different. They're all different.
Yeah. You know, you had a very... A quote from St. Francis of Assisi that you sent me. Remember that when you leave this earth, you take with you nothing that you have received, but only what you have given, a full heart, attached by honest service, love, sacrifice, and courage. That's so great. Mm-hmm. That's so perfect for the work you're doing. In a certain sense, you guys listening to this stuff puts you in the same situation, doesn't it? I mean, it's frightening, all the stories you have to hear.
It's hard. Yeah, it is.
It is hard. You know, it has the capacity.
You had some stories about the murders and when you were a copper and the guy killed a whole family and everything.
Right.
That's tough stuff. You know?
Oh, yeah. It's tough stuff. You know, what we're trying to do here is help these first responders. Because, you know, if somebody comes on a job, let's start with a copper or fireman.
Yeah.
And they think this is going to be great, that they're going to ride around, everybody's going to wave and salute them, and they're going to help people and get cats out of trees and all that, and the public's going to love them.
Yeah.
They're going to find out that they've taken a job that's hours of sheer boredom, broken only by moments of sheer terror.
Yeah.
And they're going to find out that even when they do the right thing, people don't appreciate them.
No.
They turn on them.
Yeah.
And then they don't understand the effects of stress are cumulative. You don't have a bad day because you handled a baby death today and wake up tomorrow morning and it's all gone.
Yeah.
You've got it's being deposited.
Yes.
It's being deposited in your heart, literally as well as physically.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to deal with that stress. Otherwise, if you don't, it's going to come back and bite you. It's going to come back and bite you in a lot of different ways. It's going to bite you.
It's going to bite your relationship with your family and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I remember we had a case with, it was a rape and incest case, and I was only peripherally involved. And I'm used to talking about that at the hospital, but you've got time and distance away from it.
Yeah.
And that day, our daughter, who was in high school at the time, she had a couple of, or eighth grade, something like that. She had a couple of friends over and she said, you know, can we go somewhere? And I said, no, you need to stay here. I don't want to see you crossing County Farm Road.
Yeah.
No, you stay at home. And so I was coming home from work and I see one girl dash across the six lanes, second girl, third girl.
Oh, wow.
And I pulled my car over and I sat there and I waited for them. And usually I'm pretty calm. And
yeah, you read them the riot act.
And I was kind of like, you know, typically I would have said, you knew what the rules were, blah, blah, blah. I lost my shit because I'm so,
that's okay. Yeah.
I lost it. And what I was really doing was having sat there listening to the family going like, I wish we hadn't let her. If only she had listened to us. If only we had, if only. And this girl who was their age, and it's kind of, it's kind of like being haunted in some ways, and it pops up out of nowhere, you know, out of nowhere. I have a friend who became kind of sensitive early on when I was working this, and every now and then, if there was something big, he would just text and he would go, I am there and I'm okay. And that would be it. And, and it was like,
I'm there. What you're reading about or seeing on the TV, I'm there.
Yeah. And, you know, we had a conversation about that over time. It's like, I don't expect you to do that all the time because you shouldn't take your head out of the game to let me know.
Exactly.
But then he qualified why those two times were so critical. And I was like, I'm really...
You were glad.
I was really glad that he did because I would have been like pacing all night like... and so that was something, but it does, it follows you.
What's the therapy? I mean, these people are in many cases broken, you know, they're damaged.
They're injured.
Yeah. How do you get them back to normal, or do they ever come back to normal?
Well, I think the first thing, and that's why like peer support and debriefing, the whole debriefing range of interventions. And this retreat is meant for fellowship where there's normalization. Mm-hmm. Like there are times when we're talking about our impact and we're having human experiences. We're having normal human experiences to abnormal circumstances. Yeah. But first responders don't work in normal.
Not at all.
So it's what becomes normal for us is actually outside of the range of typical normalcy. Yeah. So, you know, you've got a double adjustment there. And then you go home to people who are living in the normal world.
Yeah, they don't get it.
And and I don't know how you guys handled it, but my husband and I had talked about, we don't want it in our house.
Yeah.
So, and as a therapist, I can't come home and talk about like what's going on. And so we've had to come up with different strategies about, I really do need to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And where's the right forum for that? And who are the right people?
Yeah. And that's the retreats, right? That's one of the
And our peers. I mean, like, comfort.
The whole thing with the peers being there is, there's not somebody standing behind a lectern saying, you should do this. I've been to some people had some well-meaning stress classes way back when. I remember one guy who was an expert from an unnamed federal agency, and basically he said, yeah, you're going to have bad days, you're going to have good days, but when you have a bad day, make sure you run in the morning, eat oatmeal, and go to church every Sunday. You'll be fine.
Oh, wow.
Literally. I'm not kidding you. This was this guy's answer to stress management.
Yeah.
It's a totally different world.
Yeah.
So by having the peers there, I can relate to them. They can relate to me.
Yeah.
They start talking about something and, hey, I was there. I know what you're going through.
Yeah.
Let's talk. And we get them to open up. One of the big things, especially with cops and firemen, is to get them to open up because they've got this image. They're the big, tough, macho guys and girls.
Yeah.
They can't let anybody see that they're hurting. They can't let it'll be seen as a sign of weakness. So they have to be tough. They have to just carry on. Well, you do that. That's one of those things that, again, it's going to eat you up. It's going to eat you up in your head.
Yeah.
And it's going to eat you up in your heart. And it's going to eat you up physically. You know, it's okay. You have to learn, hey, it's okay. You got to vent. You have to vent. You have to let this stuff out. Your family. Do you need to go home and tell your family the gory details of a multi-car fatality? No, absolutely not. But you need to be able to say to that person you're living with, to those people you're living with, I had a bad day today.
Yeah.
Please give me a break.
Yeah.
We'll go do pizza tomorrow night or the next night instead of tonight. I just need some time alone. But I'm finding that before people come to this seminar and talk to the different peers, whether it's law enforcement, fire, paramedics, they've never really thought about these strategies.
Yeah.
You know, hey, you've done that? Yeah, I've done that. It worked, you know. Remember back in 95 with the heat wave,
yeah.
You know, and bodies everywhere.
Trailers filled with bodies. And everything.
People had, cops I know, worked out arrangements. They left a set of clean clothes in the garage.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And they would call and say, it was a bad day. Put that set of clothes out in the garage, you know, or put it by the shower. I'm coming in. I'm taking my clothes off. I'm going right to the shower.
Yeah.
You give people strategies, and you talk to each other like that. And people let down their defenses. The firemen love talking to firemen. Cops love talking to other cops and so on. And then you get it in the mix. It's in a small group. And those lines, those artificial lines that we see sometimes between fire and police and EMS and dispatch, they all dissolve because, you know, once you start talking, we've all been there, whether it's the dispatcher who took the call, heard the woman who ended up getting murdered screaming on the phone, trying to protect her kids.
Wow.
The paramedics who were there, the firemen who were there, did CPR, tried to bring her back, and the cops who handled the scene. Hey, we were all there. Yeah, we know about them. But, you know, and you develop strategy, and you find out you're not alone.
Yeah.
And you're not wrong for having those feelings.
No.
Because it's totally abnormal.
Yeah.
And how do you deal, and then how do you deal with it afterwards?
Right.
How do you deal with your family? How do you deal with your friends?
The important thing is to talk to your peers about it, you know, and share it, basically, right?
And then it's guided by the professionals. You don't want to go too far down the wrong path and send people spiraling back down again.
Yeah.
But you want them to talk about it, get them to a point where, hey, there is, I'm okay. Yeah. This is okay. There's nothing wrong with me because I cried.
Yes, exactly.
We actually kind of compare it to the service dogs, you know, okay, we have a comfort dog at our station, Maverick. He's a great big golden retriever. He's a big knucklehead, big floof. Uh-huh. And then we had our canine, who was also very floofy, but I admired him from a distance because he was pretty ferocious. Now, they're both mammals, right? And so their bodies respond, but how their bodies handle the stress and the tension is very different based on their training and their exposure. And so that's one of the examples that sometimes we use, is that you are a mere mortal mammal.
Yeah.
And you're asking your body to be exposed to things where that your brain is primed to either fight, flee, freeze, or fawn, you know, to avoid.
What was that last one?
Fawn, just kind of disappear, or to join together, fellowship, and come together to fight the common throw. But any time that you're paying attention to something, any time, like you're listening to this right now, your body has chemical reactions so that you can take the information in, and it's trying to decide how should I respond to it.
Yeah.
And that's normal. And when we are attending to something that is is abnormal, is in that realm of abnormal, we're pushing ourselves beyond our limits.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that so many of our discussions at the retreat and debriefings come about is how many responders actually live a lifestyle where they're always preparing for the very worst so that when it gets here that they can manage it. The problem is that they sort of change their threshold. I come out of a hospital system. In a hospital setting, 100% of my clients had suicidal ideation and were either
100%.
Yeah, wow. I dealt with high risk, self-destructive clients. And so I had to learn how to survive that. I couldn't panic every time somebody said, "Oh, your client's suicidal." And so what happens now is that I am very different than most clinicians.
Yeah.
Most clinicians will say, "Yes, I've had a couple of people who have been suicidal in their thinking." And it's kind of, you know, I remember talking to someone who was an expert in self-injury, which was one of the clinical issues I dealt with. And he said,
cutting and stuff like that.
And he said, "You know, I probably have seen more than most." And he was going on. I mean, the guy was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And so I said, "How many people do you think you've seen who engage in self-injury?" And he goes, "Now, my number is high. I'm probably at almost 20. And I looked at him and I'm like, before I got on the plane today and I did rounds, that was just downstairs.
Yeah.
You know, so it changes you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm kind of edgy,
yeah,
and I'm very pragmatic. I'm not your traditional clinician because I had to adapt,
yeah,
for that. And I think that many people don't understand how being constantly exposed to that off on the mundane, you know, driving around at night looking for open garage doors, and then all of a sudden there's a 5-car fatal, you know, boom. And then you have to go help kids cross at the school
street,
in the morning for school before you can go home. It's, you know.
Now, is this a relatively new science, though? I mean, within the last 30 years, I would think, right? Because before it was just like, suck it up, kids.
Yeah, it was campfire. It was this was where actually, like the campfire and the sitting around the station with the fire service was so invaluable because people would sit and talk.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, what we're getting, and I don't want to light any fires with the fire service, but so many of my clients who are firefighters are saying, we're sitting around all night in the TV room together, which is great, but all of them are on their phone.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not interacting. They're not dispelling the tension. But about 35 years ago, Jeff Mitchell, his brother, who is a firefighter here in Illinois, actually was killed in a line of duty death.
Uh-huh.
And as a result, Jeff started studying the impact of, I should say Dr. Mitchell started studying the impact of structured conversations around the reactions, not a tactical. They're not reviewing the tactics.
Yeah.
They're reviewing what I thought, what my reactions were, how my body is responding, and what we needed to
sort awareness.
Of come through. An awareness.
Building on an awareness, yeah.
And that evolved into debriefing, which has evolved into the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation.
So there is a format that they use, the same debriefing mm-hmm. thing for people who are in situations like that.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
So what's the best solution? More people like you and more peer support, and, right? I mean, that's the solution, I would mm-hmm. think, right?
Mm-hmm. I would love to say part of the solution would be, number one, is to empower the judicial system to actually enact the laws. that, you know, I think that that's one thing, you know, that many, many people, especially here in America, don't understand is that law enforcement officers enforce the law.
Yeah.
And that's it. And unfortunately, they've been so tasked with so many other responsibilities outside mm-hmm. of enforcing the law, you know. And when you police, and I'm sorry, I'm not a law enforcer. This is just my random observation. When you police solely to manage risk, mm-hmm. of potential lawsuits.
Oh, yeah.
You're losing sight of the importance of protecting the community.
Yeah.
Because you're protecting.
And the code for, you know, the mm-hmm. personal code that police officers have. They do good. You know?
Yeah. And so I do think that some of the solution is one, we need to make sure that some of the peer support laws that are here in America are extended to the mental health supports, providers of support. The work that I do primarily, and people like me who do wellness, and we do peer support and CISM support for the peers in that, and psychoeducation, et cetera, and so on, the non-traditional
psychoeducation.
Setting, I'm educating you about your mental health.
Okay.
That needs to be protected by law.
Yeah.
Because if you ask me, because of where my license, because I have a license and you've invited me to come educate your group,
mm-hmm.
that a very conservative attorney could make a case that I was there as a doctor and you're all my clients.
Oh, yeah.
So that's part of, I mean, like that, those sort of legal protections for officers to participate in critical incident debriefings, to participate in peer support, to participate in wellness.
Well, is critical incident report, that's mandatory, I would assume, right? When someone's in a critical incident.
No,
it's not.
No.
So the officer can say, no, I'm not doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that ain't good.
Yeah. So we tend to encourage that it be voluntary, and or they have the whole shift attend, but you don't have to participate.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Some people will go like, I don't, and we'll be like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
And then I think the second thing is you need to look at wellness holistically. So, you know, we're talking, we need to talk with all of our responders about retirement planning, physical health, financial health, spiritual health, et cetera, and familial, socials, health, and that, and also to remove some of the laws, like Illinois has the FOID reporting laws. If an officer is admitted,
firearm owner
identification.
Yeah.
So in Illinois, if you're admitted to a psych hospital for an inpatient stay, and you have a FOID card, they have to report it.
Oh no.
So if you're a cop, are you gonna go to the hospital?
No. Not if that's one of the things. Go ahead.
One of the biggest problems that we see is, first of all, the cops are reluctant to participate in the debriefings after an incident when they're conducted by their own agency, because they don't trust their agency.
Yeah. Right.
They feel that that psychologist that they're talking with is going to run back to their superiors or their chief and say,
this guy's nuts.
Take him off the street, do this, do that. Yeah. And they're also afraid that, picking up on another point that Cammy made, they're also afraid that what they say in a session might ultimately be used against them in a lawsuit.
Yeah.
So they're very reluctant to get involved with, you know, programs that are conducted by the department. And the other problem is we're seeing, you know, in the aftermath of some of the reforms, and I'll use that term lightly, in Illinois, mandating yearly mental health checkups, what we're seeing is a lot of what I'll call snake oil salespeople.
Oh, wow.
I have a degree in this.
You do the
mandatory check-in and...
Yeah.
And they're just a contract. They're checking boxes.
Yeah.
And there's no rhyme or reason to it. They don't have the experience. It's like asking a podiatrist to perform a heart surgery. Yeah. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a good outcome. We see a lot of that. And we're trying to break down the stigma to let these officers and the other first responders know, it's okay. Sit down. Talk. You have to. I keep stressing that. I know I keep stressing that. But that's it. Talk. It takes the power out of it.
Yeah.
Get it out of your system. Yeah. And then we'll work. Let's find out what's going on. And then we'll work on a cure together.
Yeah.
We'll work on a program together.
Yeah. Right. This is to get them to that point where they can sit with, I have this story. And to sit with other people who say, boy, do you. Like, the last time we had that, the young man who's a firefighter, and when he told his story, and he's like, I know you all think I don't need to be here. And almost all of the peers in the room said, what happened to you was appalling.
Oh.
And the look on his face, like, that wasn't therapy, but that was so therapeutic because he looked at all of these people who were leaders in the field, and it's like, that is not how
it's supposed
people,
to be.
Yeah, that's not.
Right. Yeah.
And so if that happens, when we wrote the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police has an officer's wellness committee.
Mm-hmm.
And we put together the officer wellness guidelines for the state based on sort of the federal guidelines. And in there, one of the sections that I have to say I think needs to go in anytime we're talking about interface of mental health with first responders was, how do you know if your provider is competent? And here's the interview that you do with them to help really tease out, is this person and is this person competent to work in this population?
I can see cops, they say, you got to go see this doctor now. They're like, oh, regret's all I need, you know. And they're going to be defensive and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And regardless of the talent or education or anything of the doctor. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of my colleagues, and I probably this is the most controversial thing I'm going to say tonight, is there are a lot of my colleagues who say, oh, I saw a first responder, you know, on my practicum, or I've had a few in my practice, so I'm competent to work with them, or I'm married to one, or I come from this. And it's like, that might be good foundation, but what have you done to learn the breadth of the field in terms of really understanding why wellness, we should not be doing notes on wellness, you know, and things like that. And how you handle when an officer talks to you about them potentially being suicidal. Mm-hmm. And
or anything that's in their head. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, they're going to chase me because they think I'm nuts or whatever.
Yeah. And the other is understanding the language. I mean, I've gotten to a point where I know, I recognize almost all of the language, but I used to, after I would talk with people, I'd have a long list, and then I'd say, so Jean, when they were saying, and so I just would imply what they meant by context, or I would say to them, can you tell me a little bit more?
Yeah.
But, you know, I have been blessed in my career, because when I first started out, I had students who were cops. And so we had a lot of interface, and I taught them about mental health side, and they taught me about law enforcement. And now we're good colleagues. We're colleagues. They got me hooked up doing tactical role play. So I was a crash test dummy for about 10 years. So I would take my students. You learn so much. And actually, one of the things that I became really good at lying there on the floor in active shooter drills was I learned, because of the conversations with people, what was going through your head when you were doing this, blah, 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 like how to read tactical teams coming in. Did they have issues? Was there an ego struggle going on? Who was not at the top of their game?
Wow.
And things like that. I learned strategies. I actually had to be the bad guy a couple of times, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
And then being a part of the critical incident team and then the other teams that I'm a part of, I had a lot of exposure. And when I first started at Bartlett, the chief said, you're going to be in the car. Oh, and they're all going to hate you. And I'm like, okay, you know, I teach academics and I've worked in a hospital. Everybody hates me. So, okay. And like, when I first started, my guys wear like navy black external carriers for their vest, and they would switch their vest up. So I could never learn their names. Like learning their first names, I never got. I half the guys who retired, I still don't know their first names. But I got good enough to go like, I know you're not Mitchell. I don't know what your name is, but from here on out, you are not Mitchell. And so, you know, pretty soon I started keeping a journal. And so if I couldn't be out of the car with them or there was some lull time somewhere, I would journal what my reactions were. And of course they were like, you're writing a textbook on me. Like, of course you are. And I'm like, no. This is like a journal entry, like what I'm learning, what I'm feeling, what I'm experiencing. Yeah. And I have a lot of questions. And then I would say, what do you want me to know about this?
Yeah.
And so my journal is actually dialogue between me and them. And hopefully I keep getting so close to getting done, but I'm editing as I write and I need to not do that. But it's called, That Bitch Almost Hit Us and Other Tales of Riding Shotgun. And it's got some folklore in it. We can't go to McDonald's on Route 59 and never order coffee with cream because you won't make it out of the McDonald's without getting some disastrous call where I never get to finish my coffee.
Yeah.
So it's like we can go to Dunkin', we can go anywhere, but not McDonald's. And so every now and then they'll go to McDonald's. It's like it's too quiet.
Yeah.
So I've never finished my coffee in the car. But you want to ask, like, what do you do to be familiar with my industry?
Yeah.
And because when you start hearing sometimes when they just need to vent some of the details, you can't be going, can you back up?
And you don't want them to feel like you're going to rat them out or anything like that.
Or like you are so shocked that they now have to take care of you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and at the same time, it's obvious I'm not a cop. I never have been a cop. So I can't act like I'm a cop.
Yeah.
Because then I'm fake. So,
well, you know, one of the things, and you may already have this in place, you need cops, firefighters to be able to come and say, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Trust these people. They helped me, mm-hmm. and they will help you. Do you have anybody doing that?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Actually, Mark Junkerman from ICISF, who's coming this weekend, he was at a conference, North Carolina, Virginia, somewhere, and someone approached him and said, oh, do you know about this great retreat that Haymarket Center is doing in Chicago?
Oh, nice,
and Mark said, actually, I'm a part of it very often. And they said, we're telling everybody to go.
Oh, good.
So right now, if you can get yourself to Chicago, we don't have the funds, the federal funds released yet.
Yeah.
But the program is free. You get yourself to Chicago. There's a shuttle from the airport.
Wow.
4 days.
Yeah.
And
it's a 4-day program. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are a number of programs that are out there.
We got to wrap this up.
There are a number of programs out there that are different. If I had my way, we would do 4 days and then we would add 3 days of intensive work for people who wanted to stay. But we do have one we'd love to do for the administration, and we'd love to do one for couples. So we got those on the back burner. But if you can get to Chicago,
you
got to
come back. What's the best way for someone who's listening to this and say, we need this. We need this at our police department, our fire department. What do they do?
Reach out to me. Haymarket has empowered me to be the one. I'm the only person they have to go
through.
How
do they get in touch with you, Cammie?
Info at kjuzwin.
K Juzwin, spell that.
JUZWIN.
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 Yeah.
Just went without the T's.
Yeah, okay.
Info at kjuzwin.com.
Okay.
And then there's also on... I can send you the flyer if
sure.
you want. And
we'll
you
put it in the you know, when the podcast goes up.
Because all the dates are there.
Oh,
all the dates are
upcoming.
Until the end of the year.
Oh, okay.
So we have them in all of the even months this year.
Yeah.
And once we know about the funding, we'll be starting to plan for 25.
Now, how long does a thing at Haymarket during the day? Is it 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, or all day? Or what's the deal?
No, the retreat itself is... starts on Sunday at noon, and we run until Wednesday at 2. And it's
not... Where do they sleep at night?
We have partnered with Hilton Corporation,
oh,
who is
wow.
a big supporter of
oh,
first responders.
No kidding.
And the Embassy
Suites. They sponsor
suite.
Our film festival, too, the Hilton. God mm-hmm. bless them. Yeah.
Gives us an amazing, amazing amount of support.
Yeah.
And we take over a floor.
Cool.
Once every couple of months for 4 days.
Yeah.
And it's pretty luxurious. Everybody is housed in their own hotel room. We start together in the morning with breakfast and we end at 8 p.m. at night after dinner.
Yeah.
And so it's really intensive.
I'll bet it is.
And
we got to go.
Okay.
What were you going to say, Gene?
No, we're all good.
You guys got to come back. This is fascinating stuff. And we salute you. God bless you so much for all the work you're doing. And we're going to take a little break here on Hibernian Radio. And we'll be right back after these messages from our friends.
With a history going all the way back to 1896, the International Union of Operating Engineers has continued to protect workers and their families with loyalty and brotherhood. Local 150 has continued to thrive through economic booms and busts with careful training and aggressive organizing. Under the leadership of President and Business Manager Jim Sweeney, Local 150 has implemented programs and action plans to create work, protect benefits, and keep members working. And they've been helping the Irish-American community of Chicagoland for just as long. The Hibernian Radio Show is proud to be associated with Jim Sweeney and Local 150, and we salute the continuing efforts of the International Union of Operating Engineers and their support of Irish and Irish-American families now and in the future. Thanks to Local 150.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry-trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste, recycling, and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers.
And we are back. Big thanks to Gene Roy and Cammy Judwoods. They were fascinating. And they'll be back. I want to remind everybody that the Emerald Society of Illinois annual Southside meeting is Thursday, April 25th at Cork and Carey in Beverly, 10614 Southwestern Avenue, 7 p.m. Drink specials including Guinness and mixed libations as well. Delicious eats catered by Calabria Catering. Music by the one and only DJ Rootin' Tootin' Billy Wooten. Performance by the finest pipes and drum band in the land, the Pipes and Drums, the Emerald Society. And the Emerald Society Commissary will be available for all your shopping needs as well. Okay, now, our old friend, Kelly Layden, police officer, St. Patrick's Day Parade Queen, and Chicago Rose of Tralee, sent me a note tonight and wants to let everybody know that the Rose of Tralee competition is May 5th at the Irish American Heritage Center, and they want everybody to get in there. You can get an application if you go to roseoftralee.ie. And Tralee is T-R-A-L-E. roseoftralee.ie and get an application for Sunday, May 5th at the Irish American Heritage Center. It's a great experience, ladies. You will have a blast and you have an opportunity to go to Ireland and go all over the world with the Roses of Tralee. So that's a good thing, and you'll be hearing more about that next week. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back after these messages from our friends.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste recycling and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers. Cops and firefighters risk their lives almost every day, so they shouldn't have to risk their hard-earned dough in any get-rich schemes or the blather of old pals in the real estate biz. And good luck trying to figure out the stock market or cryptocurrency or even economics 101 when you come home exhausted at the end of your shift. What you need is somebody you can trust, and they're in short supply these days. Hey, take it from me. I've lost fortunes in showbiz because I thought I was smarter than everybody else, and I wound up bankrupt and broke. It took me a long time to decide to find a friend I could trust who had my family's best interests at heart. That friend was my late pal, Joe Madden. I met him as he passed the basket at St. Luke's, and I'd turn my pockets inside out as he came to my pew, and I'd say, "I'm tapioca." He laughed, but didn't stop him from supporting my films and showbiz endeavors over the years. Joe Madden had my back. A few years before he died, Joe started Madden Funds with his sons, Mike and Danny. The Maddens and Houlihans have been pals for a long, long time. They can advise the best path for your investments. Madden Funds will have your back, too. Need advice on your 401k or your rollover IRA? You can trust Madden Funds to help you protect and grow your investments now and in your family's future. Go to their website, maddenfunds.com. Or call Mike or Dan Madden at 708-848-3200 and tell them who Lee sent you.
And we're back. You know, I got to apologize. We got carried away with our guests, so we don't have time to do the obits tonight. We're going to do them next week. So we're going to put them on ice. We're going to put all the dead people on ice, and we'll bring them all out next week and have plenty of obits next week. Now, I want to tell you about a local farmer. He has successfully grown a field of vibrators. Can you believe that? Unfortunately, he now has a problem with squatters. Hey, everybody. What a great show. Next week is Bill Kassane. And we'll see you later. Bye. Thanks so much.